Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. A sack of homemade bombs discovered at an abandoned Boko Haram camp exploded, killing 63 people in northeastern Nigeria, according to civil defense fighters Wednesday. Harun Bakar is a witness to the blast and said that the local militia was patrolling the area when they discovered the camp and found the bag of metal objects, which they carried to the nearby town of Munguno. As residents gathered around to examine the bag, it exploded. Scores of people have been killed this month in suicide and other bombings carried out by Nigeria's homegrown extremists using these kinds of improvised explosive devices. Human Rights Watch said Wednesday that authorities from the internationally recognized government in Libya are responsible for forcing confessions, not providing medical care, and denying due process to detainees. The group issued a statement detailing the accusations based on what it said were visits to three detention centers in eastern Libya controlled by the Army and Interior Ministry in January and April. The sites in Benghazi and Al-Baida collectively held 450 detainees, according to Human Rights Watch, with about half reporting being tortured while in custody, and all of them saying they were not allowed to talk to lawyers, go before a judge, or be formally charged. U.S. President Barack Obama's strategy for combating Islamic State militants is to be a major focus Wednesday as his defense secretary and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff go before a panel of lawmakers in Washington to discuss the situation in the Middle East. The defense chief Ashton Carter and the Joint Chiefs of Chairman General Martin Dempsey are scheduled to testify at a hearing of the House Armed Services Committee. VOA News. The Greek central bank has warned that failure to reach a bailout deal with its international creditors will result in recession, a decline in income levels, and possibly even a withdrawal from the eurozone. The central bank issued its statement Wednesday. It comes a day before eurozone finance ministers meet to discuss how to get more emergency funds to Greece by June 30th. That's when Athens is obligated to make a $1.8 billion repayment to the International Monetary Fund. In a statement Wednesday, the bank said a default on that payment could set off a chain of events that might even lead to Greece dropping out of the common European currency used by 18 of its neighbors. China and Australia have signed a landmark free trade agreement that follows about a decade of negotiations. The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott and the Chinese Trade Minister Guo Cheng attended the signing ceremony Wednesday in Canberra. This is Trade Minister Gao.
The China-Australia FTA has attained its goal of being a comprehensive, high-quality, and balanced agreement. It has the highest degree of liberalization amongst all the FTAs that China has so far signed with another economy. This signing is going to provide us with a more open, convenient, and regulated institutional arrangement for our trade and investment exchanges going forward.
Under the pact, tariffs eventually will be lifted on 95% of Australian exports, according to the official Xinhua news agency. Swiss prosecutors are investigating 53 possible money laundering incidents involving the bidding process for the 2018 and the 2022 FIFA World Cup tournaments. Swiss Attorney General Michael Lauber said Wednesday that the transactions were reported by banks through Switzerland's anti-money laundering alert system. Lauber told reporters that he does not rule out interviewing FIFA President Sepp Blatter, who has agreed to step down in the wake of the scandal engulfing football's governing body.
There will be formal interviews of all relevant people. By definition, this does not exclude interviewing the president of FIFA, and this does not exclude interviewing the Secretary General of FIFA.
FIFA has suspended the bidding process for the 2026 World Cup because of this ongoing controversy. The World Health Organization said Wednesday that the outbreak of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome in South Korea shows the urgent need for greater international readiness to fight infectious diseases. However, the organization does not consider the MERS outbreak to be a public health emergency of international concern. That's thanks to quick South Korean action to contain the disease. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
He should come out and take responsibility first for the failures in the system, because he has been part of the system. He should apologize for the failures that the government did. And then he should maybe go ahead and tell the people, this is the new beginning for us.
That's a report from Kampala. Details coming up.
Also in the news, a Cairo court delivers the death sentence to former President Mohamed Morsi yesterday as protesters outside the courtroom chanted in protest.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the European Union again failed to reach agreement yesterday on relocating more than 40,000 migrants from Africa and Syria. Only 10 of the 28 member nations agreed yesterday to a quota system for receiving those who are approved for asylum. In the last 6 months, an estimated 100,000 have moved along two major routes across the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy and to Greece. Increasing numbers are seeking other passage into the Balkans. Hungary has experienced a sharp increase in asylum requests over the last year. In Budapest today, the foreign ministry announced the government is considering building a 13-foot-high fence to stop a flow of migrants coming across their border with Serbia.
A Cairo court delivered the death sentence to former President Mohamed Morsi yesterday as protesters outside the courtroom chanted in protest. Morsi, 63, and three other members of a major opposition party had been charged with breaking out of jail during the 2011 political revolution that ended the rule of President Hosni Mubarak. The Grand Mufti approved the verdict of the three-judge panel, which had first announced its ruling in May. More than 80 other members of the Muslim Brotherhood, who earlier fled the country, were also given the death penalty. Morsi served for 1 year before he was ousted by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces during mass protests against his rule. He is the only civilian to serve as Egypt's president since the overthrow of the monarchy 63 years ago. In a crackdown on public dissent, President and former General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi banned Morsi's political party.
The U.S. State Department expressed deep concern for Egypt's judicial practice of holding mass trials of political opponents. Egyptian courts have also convicted 17 members of the Brotherhood of spying. Morsi and 17 others were also sentenced to life terms on charges of spying for Hamas, Lebanese militants, Hezbollah, and Iran. Since Morsi's arrest in 2013, hundreds have died in the Sinai Peninsula, where extremists of Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis have targeted the Egyptian military. Today, a bomb struck a military vehicle in the Sinai's largest city, El Arish, killing one soldier and wounding four.
A longtime friend and short-time rival of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has announced his bid for president. Amama Mbabazi says democracy and faith must be restored to the country. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala that President Museveni is hitting back.
A longtime friend and short-time rival of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has announced his bid for president. Amama Mbabazi says democracy and faith must be restored to the country. Elizabeth Polab reports from Kampala, President Museveni is hitting back. After years of speculation, Ugandans awoke Monday to news that former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi would be running for president in 2016. Mr. Mbabazi made his declaration on YouTube, saying the current system of government must be reinvigorated. It is seen as a sharp blow to President Yoweri Museveni, who was a close ally to Mr. Mbabazi for nearly 30 years. Both worked together to establish the nation's ruling political party, the National Resistance Movement, as well as the current government. But about 2 years ago, a rift began to form between them. Many speculated it was because Mr. Mbabazi had overstepped politically, trying to seize more power. On Tuesday, President Museveni responded to Mr. Mbabazi's declaration with his own video, accusing the former prime minister of wasting everyone's time with such a premature announcement. He also asked how somebody who had been a key player in government for so long could demonize the current shape of the nation. While some have criticized the video, saying it makes Mr. Museveni appear scared and defensive, political blogger Michael Freeman Ojula thinks it was the right move.
The posting of that video, Museveni video online, that is the kind of president Ugandans want to see. They want to see that kind of president who just doesn't keep in hiding when something wrong is happening. They want a reactive president. It is shown that he has given even Mbabazi a freedom to say what he feels like saying. So it has actually played him a very good PR.
Mr. Mbabazi says he intends to run within the NRM party, a party he was secretary general of until late last year when Mr. Museveni, the NRM chairman, removed him. To run under the NRM, Mr. Mbabazi will have to be approved within the party ranks as a candidate. Although difficult, some observers are saying it's not impossible. Political analyst Owen Arima explains why the former prime minister has to be careful with his strategy.
I think he should come out and take responsibility first for the failures in the system, because he has been part of the system. He should apologize for the failures that the government did, which he was part of. And then he should maybe go ahead and tell the people, this is the new beginning for us. But if Mbabazi plays victim, which I suspect he will, I don't think very many Ugandans are going to like him. And the fact that Ugandans will not forget the things he did. You know why? Because NRM will constantly remind them.
The Electoral Commission has chastised Mr. Mbabazi for his announcement, which it says is ahead of the campaign program. Government spokesman Afuanua Pondo also came out against Mr. Mbabazi on social media, saying that he started a war that he will not win. On the other side, Mr. Mbabazi's supporters accused the government of tearing down campaign posters and arresting supporters. But many see his declaration as a game changer, which has sparked lively debate across Kampala, leaving many to wonder what Mr. Mbabazi's next move will bring for the future of government, the NRM, and Uganda. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Organizers of a campaign to end sexual exploitation and abuse in UN peacekeeping operations say the United Nations came close yesterday but fell short of that goal. The advocacy organization AIDS Free World had launched its Code Blue campaign to end the use of immunity for UN non-military personnel accused of such crimes. Yesterday, the UN high-level independent panel on peacekeeping operations did address the issue, but not to the satisfaction of campaign organizers. Paula Donovan is co-director of AIDS Free World. From New York, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the scope of the problem.
The problem is that sexual exploitation and abuse is quite a serious concern of the United Nations when we're talking about its peacekeeping contingents, currently in 16 missions around the world. And in 2003, the then Secretary General issued a declaration that there was zero tolerance for sexual exploitation and abuse throughout the UN and certainly in its peacekeeping operations. Unfortunately, the problem is continuing year after year, and although the UN says the allegations of sexual exploitation or abuse are going down on a regular basis, every study has determined that, in fact, the UN has no idea how many cases are actually ongoing because people either don't know how to report or they're afraid to report or they simply think it's futile. The reason they think it's futile, we believe, is that people who are accused of these egregious crimes and offenses are never really brought to justice. The civilian peacekeepers, they have immunity from all legal process unless and until the Secretary General decides to waive that immunity.
Now, there was a meeting yesterday at the UN where the high-level independent panel on peacekeeping operations had issued a report to the Secretary General. Did that report deal at all with sexual abuse among peacekeeping operations?
It did, and the panel reinforced what the United Nations says on a regular basis, which is that immunity never applies to sexual exploitation and abuse. The chair of the panel, former President José Ramos Horta, actually came out much more strongly than his colleagues on the panel And he said that immunity actually does present an obstacle because although once the United Nations has started its own investigation, which can take anywhere from 1 month to 62 months, in other words, the United Nations intervenes and says before law enforcement can weigh in, we ourselves are going to send a team and determine whether we think the victim has made a credible case and justice should be pursued. And that's just a terrible obstacle to justice being pursued.
Now, you're saying this panel fell short of what you wanted. How did it do that?
By simply reinforcing the UN's sort of party line that the problem doesn't exist, that the problem of sexual exploitation and abuse is diminishing each year, which we don't believe is true. The reports are showing that tens of thousands of peacekeepers are engaging in transactional sex, and that by their own accounts, those who do report these offenses number in the several hundreds. The panel itself, by consensus, said there is no immunity for sexual exploitation and abuse. What the chairperson, Ramos Horta, independently has assessed for himself is that actually immunity does interfere until such time that the United Nations has decided that immunity should not hold and it should be waived by the Secretary General. So unlike the rest of humankind, if we're accused of a sexual offense, then the police move in immediately to make the determination. The UN says, hold on, law enforcement, we're going to take over this step of the process and we'll determine on our own time whether or not this accusation is verifiable and credible and whether or not we think there's enough evidence here to turn things over to local law enforcement and let justice take its course.
What actually needs to be done, in your view, to actually formally eliminate any chance of immunity in cases of alleged sexual abuse?
The easiest thing is for the Secretary General to immediately issue a bulletin that says the minute anyone hears of an allegation of sexual exploitation or abuse, then right away the local law enforcement should move in. The UN should not be involved in the determination. And because there is no immunity in these cases, then we're going to reverse things and we're going to say the blanket that covers all UN staff and shields them from any involvement in legal processes does not include coverage of any sexual offenses.
Paula Donovan is co-director of AIDS Free World from New York. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The European Union again failed to reach agreement yesterday on relocating more than 40,000 migrants from Africa and Syria. A Cairo court delivered the death sentence to former President Mohamed Morsi yesterday as protesters outside the courtroom chanted in protest. And a longtime friend of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has announced his bid for president and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The U.S. is launching a study in Liberia of the long-term consequences of the Ebola epidemic. The study is being conducted by the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The Liberian Ministry of Health is a co-sponsor of the research. Director Anthony Fauci says the study will include about 1,500 who survived Ebola and another 6,000 who came in close contact with the virus. The World Health Organization reports that in the past week, there has been a slight increase in new cases, 17 in Guinea and 15 in Sierra Leone. More than 11,000 died in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia since the outbreak began in December 2013. Approximately 27,000 were infected. No new infections have been found in Liberia since May 9th.
The United Nations and South Africa's Defense Ministry have dismissed reports that South African troops were at risk until President Omar al-Bashir returned home from South Africa. Last weekend, a South African judge had ordered the government to detain President Bashir, who was attending an African Union conference in Johannesburg. The High Court was acting in response to the warrant for his arrest issued by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes. President Bashir left South Africa unimpeded by authorities. South Africa's news outlet, News 24, reports. Military sources say South African peacekeepers stationed in Sudan's Darfur province were threatened by Sudanese forces until President Bashir was allowed to return home. The UN mission in Darfur has denied the report.
Meanwhile, the debate continues over the failure of authorities to detain Mr. Bashir. The South African government says he had diplomatic immunity while attending the AU summit. Others say, as a member state of the International Criminal Court, South Africa was obligated to arrest him. Mark Ellis is the executive director of the International Bar Association in London. VOA reporter William Eagle asked him for his view on the matter.
In this case, international law would trump the political objective set forth by the African Union. There's just no question about that. I understand politically the AU's perception on the ICC as being African-centric, for instance, although I don't think that's accurate because the African cases are cases that have been brought to the court either by the African states themselves or by a referral by the UN Security Council. So it's not as if you've had a rogue prosecutor focusing all of his or her attention on Africa. That's simply not the reality. But the African Union's perception that the ICC is interested almost exclusively on Africa, I think has some merit because of the reality that that's where the cases are right now, at least the majority of the cases. And the fact is that the major political powers, including the United States, China, Russia, Israel, are not members. They've not signed up to the ICC, to the Rome Statute. And so there is a gap here. And I think that gap has created this perception that the ICC is not focused internationally, but is focused on a much more narrow bandwidth. And so I understand the perception, but still, international law trumps that political perception because South Africa, in this case, signed the Rome Statute, and it has a legal obligation to abide by the decisions of the ICC. And in this case, to arrest and transfer al-Bashir to The Hague.
My understanding is that the head of the ICC had moved this case to a lower level or maybe suspended it because of a lack of support from the Security Council. Just in situations like this, in trying to pursue President Bashir, who has gone to other countries and not been apprehended.
You are absolutely accurate. And this is South Africa. This is not the first instance where you had President al-Bashir traveling to a state party country. Nigeria is one, the DRC is one, Kenya is one. So it has happened before. And it comes back to this point that you've made, that is that when that happens, the state parties are obligated under the Rome Statute to apprehend, arrest, and transfer. Clearly, that has not happened over the past 6 years since al-Bashir was first indicted by the ICC. Once there's that kind of degree of non-cooperation, then the prosecutor can go to the Security Council and say, we need your help. We need you as a Security Council to provide further incentives or disincentives against these states that are failing to cooperate with our court. And to date, the Security Council has done absolutely nothing.
Has the ICC in the past ever sort of exercised its right to offer incentives or disincentives in a case similar to this in support of the ICC?
What happens is when a state party refuses to cooperate with the very court that it that it has signed up to do. Then there's something called an assembly of state parties, and that's all of the signatories to the Rome Statute, and they meet periodically. And it's within that assembly that there is supposed to be further support or further pressure on its own members to cooperate and do what they're supposed to do in support of the court. But internally, that has really broken down. That is not, I don't think, in an effective, efficient way. And the al-Bashir case is a prime example. So even when the court has gone to its own assembly of state parties, all of the countries that have signed up to the Rome Statute, even when the court has gone back to the assembly of state parties and said, we need you to pressure these various countries that are part of your community, they're part of the assembly, to support the court, the assembly of state parties has failed to do that as well. So the court has been in a situation where it can't even rely on its own group of states who signed up to support the court to do that. And that has been a real, I think, very traumatic reality for the court, that its own members are permitting other state parties to ignore their responsibility in supporting the court.
That's Mark Ellis, Executive Director of the International Bar Association in London. He spoke with reporter William Eagle.
Today is World Sickle Cell Day. Cameroon is raising awareness of the disease and asking couples to carry out genotype tests before getting married to avoid the disease, a genetic disorder primarily seen in people of African descent. A campaign against the fading age-long superstitious belief that sickle cell is divine punishment for wrongdoing and children with the disease are mysterious children has been launched. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Today is World Sickle Cell Day. Cameroon is raising awareness of the disease and asking couples to carry out genotype tests before getting married to avoid the disease, a genetic disorder primarily seen in people of African descent. A campaign against the fading age-long superstitious belief that sickle cell is divine punishment for wrongdoing and children with the disease are mysterious children has been launched. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA in Yaoundé. 27-year-old Teke Marcel has been living with sickle cell, a disorder in which red blood cells contain an abnormal type of hemoglobin. He says he has joined 100 other patients to march in Yaoundé to demand changes in the healthcare system to help people with this type of chronic disease. He says an average total cost of care is about $1,000 in Cameroon.
What we need at the hospital is like some reductions of the medical laboratory test. Then also we need the hospital maybe to give us some kind of reduction in our hospital bills.
Dr. Caroline Zana, who treats sickle cell patients, says she and other protesters are also pressing to end prejudices against people living with the disease. She says many Cameroonians believe sickle cell patients suffer from some divine punishment for their or their parents' wrongdoing and are abandoned to die.
We come together so that the government can know that this is a public health problem and it needs to be dealt with. Many people are ashamed to talk about it. Many people are just, you know, what is sickle cell? How does it affect people? Because it's genetic, which means that you inherit it. If your parents have the trait, so most of these traits are found in Africa.
Dr. Nzana says it is possible to eradicate the disease if people carry out medical consultations before marriage and before making babies. She says those who are already sick can live with the disease thanks to advanced medical research.
It's very, very expensive to cure because you will have a bone marrow transplant. It's the bone marrow that produces your red blood cells. You have to transplant that bone marrow such that it will start producing the normal type of red blood cells. But research is still going on. But to be honest with you, if you manage sickle cell very well, you can survive up to 50, 60, 70 years.
Krista Tomo, an official of Sickle Cell Friends, a non-governmental organization that helps people stricken with the disease, says they are encouraging people to participate in control programs as a sure means of eradicating sickle cell.
My role.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union again failed to reach agreement yesterday on relocating more than 40,000 migrants from Africa and Syria. A Cairo court delivered the death sentence to former President Mohamed Morsi yesterday as protesters outside the courtroom chanted in protest. And a longtime friend and short-time rival of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has announced his bid for president. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda and in our feature segment, providing nutrition to Malawian children. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Vuhi. Bands, we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos today for a California-based basketball team.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Golden State Warriors, who won their first National Basketball Association championship in 40 years. The Warriors scored a 105-97 road victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers to win the NBA Finals 4-2. League MVP Stephen Curry scored 25 points for the Warriors, a total matched by teammate Andre Iguodala. The 31-year-old Iguodala, whose father is Nigerian, was named the most valuable player of the NBA Finals. Golden State's head coach is Steve Kerr, who won 5 NBA titles as a player and now his first as a coach. Kerr began his post-game news conference with praise for the Cavaliers.
Congratulations to Cleveland, to Coach Blatt, who did a fantastic job. You think about the injuries they had, 2 of their top 3 players going down. And for them to have the season that they had and to get to the finals and to compete at the highest level and to have us on the ropes, it's an amazing job. And obviously LeBron is just an incredible player. So congrats to the Cavs. We were fortunate in a lot of ways this year. Maybe number one was health. To win a title, there's obviously a lot of work, but a lot of luck as well. And we had a lot of luck on our side this year, and our guys took advantage of it, and they were fantastic. But, man, what a night.
As Coach Kerr said, LeBron James is an incredible basketball player. He averaged almost 36 points, 13 rebounds, and 9 assists each game during the NBA Finals. But it was not enough for Cleveland to win its first NBA title. One of the key players for the Warriors in their title-clinching victory was forward Draymond Green, who had a team-high 11 rebounds and 10 assists. Green says the club's savior in the NBA Finals, though, was Andre Iguodala.
Andre is that guy that we all look to when everything going bad. I mean, whether it's him taking a back seat and letting Harrison start, you know, and not mumbling a word about coach's decision all year. And then coming in, he was great the entire series, not just when he started starting. He was great the entire series, but he saved this season for us. I always say Andre's a pro's pro. He's a professional guy, and it showed, and that's why he's the MVP of this series, and that's why we're champions.
That's Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors, the 2015 NBA champions. In African youth football, neighbors Mali and Senegal saw their world championship dreams come to an end Wednesday in the semifinals of the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand. Mali lost to Serbia 2-1 in extra time, while Senegal was beaten decisively by Brazil 5-0. Mali and Senegal have one more game to play before they go home, as they will play each other Saturday in the third-place game in Auckland. The final featuring Brazil and Serbia will also take place Saturday in Auckland. Meanwhile, 2 African teams are headed in different directions at the Women's World Cup in Canada, Neighbors Cameroon and Nigeria both played their crucial final group stage matches Tuesday. Both teams needed a win if they hoped to advance, and Cameroon was up to the task, coming from behind to defeat a strong Swiss team 2-1. Nigeria, on the other hand, played a tough game against world number two USA, and despite several good chances for the Super Falcons, the American women were able to squeeze by with a 1-0 win on a goal just before halftime by Abby Wambach. It was Wambach's 183rd career international goal, the most by any player, male or female, in history. The Super Falcons played the last 21 minutes with 10 women after Sarah Enodim received a second yellow card. With the loss, Nigeria finishes the group stage with 1 point and is eliminated. Cameroon, on the other hand, finishes with 6 points in Group C, good enough for second place. Cameroon now joins Brazil, Japan, China, the USA, Norway, Canada, Germany, and Australia in the knockout stages. The Cameroonian ladies will play China on Saturday in the round of 16. Cameroon is just the second African team to ever make it to the knockout stage of the Women's World Cup. An impressive feat for a team making its Women's World Cup debut. Nigeria advanced to the knockout stage at the 1999 tournament here in the United States. Well, our African football guru, David Legg, has been looking at the recent 2017 Nations Cup qualifiers played across the continent. There were 25 matches in total, spanning 13 qualifying groups. In Group D, the two home teams were victorious. In Kampala, the Cranes of Uganda defeated the Zebras of Botswana 2-0. And in Ouagadougou, the Stallions of Burkina Faso galloped past the Comoros Islands by that same 2-0 scoreline. How do you see this group, David?
The same applies to Burkina Faso's Mali. I was expecting them to win a little bit more convincingly, remembering that Comoros Islands are one of the newest national teams playing in Africa. But in fact, it was 9 minutes from the end when Bertrand Traoré scored a second Burkinabe goal to clinch the victory. The first had come from that big striker, Aristide Bance, a man who always stands out because he's got that blonde-dyed hairstyle. And he's huge. He could well have been a basketball player, Sonny, or even a rugby union player. Really strong, powerful footballer is Bance. The other result, Sonny, also pretty predictable. You would always fancy Uganda at home against Botswana. And they scored their two goals within 11 minutes early in the second half. Jeffrey Massa, who plays in South Africa, he put the Ugandan Cranes ahead. And Brian Umoni, who used to play in South Africa, he scored the second goal. So pretty predictable there. And their dead level, the only thing that puts Burkina Faso ahead of Uganda is because their name begins with a B as opposed to the U of Uganda. So they're level on 3 points and a level on +2 goal difference. The next set of matches, Sonny, will see Botswana at home to Burkina Faso and the Comoros at home to Uganda.
David, I know you like to remind Douglas Mpuga and our many Voice of America listeners in Uganda that it's been a long time since 1978 when the Cranes last qualified for the Nations Cup. Could Gabon 2017 finally be the time for Uganda football?
Tell you, when we talk of Uganda, we must always say could. We never say will. Yes, I think if Douglas wants some encouragement, I think they have a fair chance. This is not the strongest of groups, honey, and really it should boil down to Burkina Faso and Uganda. The crucial thing for the Ugandans, as were all teams in the Africa Cup of Nations, they must win their three home games. If you go back to the 2015 qualifiers, Uganda started well, and then they lost at home to Togo, and that really was the death knell, ultimately, of their chances. This time, a solid home performance, 2-0 against Botswana. Botswana, obviously, pretty defensive, but the Ugandans patiently carving out a victory. And yes, Sonny, I would say at this stage, definitely a 50-50 chance. I really cannot see Botswana or Comoros challenging for top place. So it could well boil down to those two matches between Burkina Faso and Uganda, one in Ouagadougou and one in Kampala. And what the Ugandans obviously have to aim at is winning in Kampala and at least drawing in Ouagadougou. So, Sonny, yeah, our fingers are crossed tightly for Douglas on this one.
Let's turn to Group E now, David. We had draws in both matches. Zambia, the 2012 Nations Cup champion, playing at home in Ndola, scoreless draw with Guinea-Bissau. And Congo-Brazzaville plays a one-all draw with Kenya. Your thoughts?
Good news for Kenya, and also good news for Guinea-Bissau. I think Group E is going to be humdinger. I really think Congo, Kenya, or Zambia could win this group. I mean, Guinea-Bissau could yet make me eat my words, quite literally, because that was an impressive performance. They went to Ndola and forced a nil-all draw against a country who, we must remember, were the shock winners of the 2012 Cup of Nations. Zambia had a great chance to win the match right to the death. In fact, 1 minute into stoppage time, a needlessly, clumsily conceded handball by a Guinea-Bissau defender gifted Zambia a penalty and upstepped the man who so often converts these spot kicks, the goalkeeper of Zambia, the veteran Kennedy Mwini. However, Sonny, I've seldom seen such a badly taken penalty. He struck the ball so timidly, and he struck it straight down the middle. The Guinea-Bissau goalkeeper managed to just kick the ball away, and that was the great chance of the Zambian victory gone astray. So Zambia having to settle for a point at home, not a good start at all. And Congo Brazzaville, who impressed us all at the 2015 Cup of Nations, reaching the quarterfinals, leading DR Congo 2-0 before eventually being vanquished by 4-2. They didn't play particularly well, and that in part must go to the credit of the Kenyans, who were very combative, led through Were after 10 minutes. Onyango equalized after 35 minutes from a penalty. But the Kenyans pretty comfortable in the second half in a match played in Owando, atop in the north of the country. Now, the Congolese normally play either in Brazzaville or down in Pointe Noire on the Atlantic coast. But a change of venue this time, and the Congolese are ahead only because their name begins with a C, whereas the Kenyans' name begins with a K. And the next matches, which I think will be really eagerly looked forward to by Guinea-Bissau and Kenya, Guinea-Bissau will be at home to Congo, and Kenya will be at home to Zambia. And if you think about it, if the Guinea-Bissau and Kenyans can win those matches, they will have built a 3-point lead each after two rounds. So I think, Sonny, let's mark down Group E. I've got a hunch this is going to be a really intriguing mini-league.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And David will be back later this week with more Nations Cup qualifying analysis. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, providing nutrition to children of Malawi. And next, thousands of Burundians fleeing to Tanzania. But for some music, here is Blue 3 of Uganda with Hitaji.
Hitaji Mbeni, Chibombo.
making you nervous.
KZ from South Africa with Shibodo.
Well, stunted growth caused by malnutrition affects about 50% of children in Malawi. There's no cure for stunting, which can cause developmental and physical problems. However, good nutrition from an early age can easily prevent it. A program led by the Children's Investment Fund and the World Food Program provides nutrition to Malawian children. VOA's Anita Powell talks to project coordinator Georgina Fakete via Skype from Malawi.
Thanks for talking to us, Georgina. Can you tell us what this project is all about?
I'm in Malawi this week with a team, and we're working with the World Food Programme, the UN World Food Programme, to support the government of Malawi to address undernutrition. So nutrition matters in Malawi for children's growth, not only for their physical growth, to ensure that they grow tall and strong in teenagers and then become strong adults, but also the development of their brains. And this is really important. We see this as a really important issue because if we don't address good nutrition, we're stealing futures by holding children back.
So how big of a problem are malnutrition and stunting in Malawi?
Malawi has very high rates of stunting, so short height or age. It's almost half of children are stunted and around 1 million, that's 1.4 million of children in Malawi. So it's a huge burden that exists in Malawi. 18% of school year repetitions are due to stunting, and children who are stunted are more likely to drop out of school. And then if you look at the society at large, and this is really important, often people overlook this because it's often seen as a health issue, when in fact it's really about bigger society issues, including the economy. If you look at the recent report that was issued, and we see that undernutrition is costing countries like Malawi a huge amount. So annually it's around $600 million. Which is around 10% of GDP, which is enormous.
What kind of results are you seeing with your supplemental feeding program and educational programs?
So we've reached, or the program through the World Food Program, working with World Vision and the government in the Nchisi district, has reached 25,000 participants, which is on the way to the target. The four-year program will reach around 66,000 participants. And we're seeing really great participation rates, which is well above 80%, so that's on target as well. It's really positive. Those results haven't yet come out, but one more thing I wanted to demonstrate was while the product is helping to increase dietary diversity, it's actually increasing roughly, and this is what we heard, three times what kids have from their normal diet. And we've also had some anecdotal evidence. So we met with the women and we asked them, so what change have you seen? And so they mentioned that their children are growing much faster than some of their siblings have, but they also said that they're much more alert. And this is really goes back to my point where I explained that nutrition really matters for cognitive development. It's about brain development and making sure that not only are you strong physically, but that your brain is really active.
And finally, Georgina, is there anything else you'd like to say to our global audience?
I think I just really reinforce to the listeners how much nutrition matters. It's really not an issue to overlook. It's really not only a health issue. It's really got economic benefits. If you invest in nutrition, you really have good returns in the long term. So it's worth doing that at every level and not ignoring the issue because it often gets ignored and falls through the cracks. So it really matters.
Georgina Fakete is project coordinator for the Children's Investment Fund and the World Food Program. She was speaking with VOA's Anita Powell from Malawi.
Thousands of Burundians are continuing to cross into northwestern Tanzania. According to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, more than 90,000 refugees have fled the country. Reporter Edward Ruima visited Nyaragusu refugee camp in Kigoma in western Tanzania and sent us this report.
Hundreds of Burundians continue to flee into neighboring Tanzania, citing increased tension, intimidation, and threats in the nation related to elections and the decision by the current president to seek another term in office. Once they have crossed the border, these refugees, who are mostly comprised of women and children, are transported to Nyarugusu camp in Kigoma, western Tanzania. This woman said she and her four young kids fled because of Imbonerakure, a youth wing of the ruling party CNDD-FDD. She said she was harassed because she was not a member of the party in power, and that is why she decided to flee. The UNHCR field officer in charge of Burundian refugees in Nyarugusu told the Voice of America that they were receiving between 300 to 500 Burundian refugees a day. As of this week, the total number of registered refugees was 53,000 in just a span of 2 months.
We are expecting and hoping that international community will support this operation. The current challenges, that is also, as I mentioned, in terms of health, water sanitation and shelter. And since we are in the emergency phase, so these are our priorities. And once the situation is stabilized, then we will look into other sectors as well, for example, education and community services.
UNHCR and its partners have been providing basic assistance at the camp, but it has been a challenge to keep pace with the rate of arrivals. Some of the refugees complain of lack of essential items, such as plastic sheets, blankets, mattresses, lack of enough food, and adequate access to health care. This man, aged 75, says life has been hard for them because of lack of enough tents for shelter. He says he's been sleeping outside for a while now. The hospital at the camp has also been struggling to cater for the tens of thousands of refugees living in dire conditions and difficult health conditions. More than 20 people were infected with cholera at the camp. However, according to Dr. Florence Mushana, the health coordinator at Nyarugusu camp, the outbreak ranging among Burundian refugees has slowed significantly.
Yeah, we have cases of acute watery diarrhea, and after testing was confirmed to be cholera. Positive were about 22, but now was already contained in collaboration with UNHCR, UN International Agency, as well as WHO, government. Since Saturday, we don't have any new case of diarrhea.
While tens of thousands of people continue to flee Burundi, the government insists there is no insecurity or violence in the country for people to leave their homes. Willie Nyamitwe, a senior advisor in the president's office, told the Voice of America that people are fleeing because of rumors.
When you go to meet them, you'll find that none of them has been injured. None of them has been tells or claims that he has lost any of his siblings or belongings. That means people are fleeing because of rumors.
Recent regional heads of state summit held in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania to discuss the political crisis in Burundi urged the political leadership to exercise restraint and to ensure the right environment of refugees who fled the conflict to return home.
That's reporter Edward Ruwama at Nyarugusu refugee camp in northwestern Tanzania. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf
behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since 2009, when it began a campaign to overthrow the government of Nigeria and establish a regime based allegedly on a strict interpretation of Islamic law, the criminal terrorist group known as Boko Haram has wreaked death and destruction across much of that nation's northern half. It has perpetrated countless unprovoked attacks on men, women, and children in their homes, schools, places of worship, and businesses, claiming thousands of lives and forcing hundreds of thousands to flee their homes. Over time, Boko Haram has taken the battle to Nigeria's neighbors in Benin, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger, causing additional death and mayhem. Recognizing the expanding regional nature of the terror group, the United States has provided support in the region in confronting it. Now, as nations in the region mount a major military offensive against the group under the leadership of the African Union and the Lake Chad Basin Commission, we are increasing our support for these efforts. This commitment is firm and will continue for as long as the nations in the region welcome it. We are fully committed to helping the security forces defend their national territories. Boko Haram must not be allowed to continue brutally terrorizing innocent civilians anywhere. This unchecked killing must stop. The United States stands firmly with the governments of Benin, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria in the face of this serious threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.